Blog Talk Radio.
Because it deals with the Palestinian issue in a way
is very pro-Palestinian. And, of course, everyone knows that the media is pretty well controlled by Zionist sympathizers, Israeli sympathizers, and it's very difficult to get good, real, or true works out of major publishers today. But let us, I want to go through this and just read the introduction. If I can. He starts off with a quote from Martin Luther King Jr. It says, "Cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? And there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe nor politic nor popular, but one must take it because it is right." That's by Martin Luther King Jr. And that, the way that started to me, that, I mean, he's absolutely right on the money, as far as I'm concerned, because I've kind of, my whole career and whatever it's been in broadcasting has been for that, to tell to state as much truth as I possibly can, and truth to power as much as we can, and damn the torpedoes, you know, for what it's worth. But let me go on. And he begins, "Even those with good intentions misunderstand what happened in Palestine with regard to popular resistance. Jesse Jackson Sr. once wrote an open letter to Yasser Arafat urging a strategy of nonviolence to achieve statehood. Similarly, in an address to the Muslim world in Cairo, President Barack Obama asked Palestinians to struggle for a state by nonviolent means. As well meaning as these two men are, they fail to understand the true nature of the struggle by reducing the message to a statement about the undesirability of violence on the part of an oppressed people. Both ignore the rich history of precisely such nonviolent struggle while failing to appreciate what Palestinians really want. Freedom and the right of return, not a flag over a canton called a state. Though Jackson and Obama are more understanding than others in the West, right-wing individuals like Dick Cheney and Tony Blair and neoliberals with Zionist leanings like Thomas Friedman deliver far harsher Orientalist lectures. We also see a minimization or total ignorance among those in the West of the far more deadly violence required and exerted to achieve a Jewish state in a land that before 1917 had a Jewish population of less than 7%. It is logical that foreigners who have not experienced what we experience should ask us to adopt nonviolence in our struggle against an apartheid colonial system. Is this not more problematic when such Westerners ignore the great work accomplished by Palestinians and internationals to effect real change over the decades and without the use of arms? As we report in this book, the reality is that popular resistance in Palestine developed indigenously, organically, naturally, and beautifully. And it has accelerated in the past two decades. An internet search of Palestinian popular resistance now gives over 8.5 million hits. This resistance was the continued. This resistance was and continues to be against the Zionist goal of transforming a central part of the Arab world from a multi-ethnic and multi-religious society into a Jewish state, a goal that required 1, support from world powers; 2, convincing organizations and mobilizing Jews for Zionism; and 3, crushing all and any and all resistance from the negative population. Securing international support proved to be an achievable task due to the number of Zionists in key positions in Western countries. But crushing local resistance was more difficult than anticipated. The Palestinians' refusal to be dispossessed quietly was met with increasingly harsh oppression throughout the decades. The Palestinian people rose from the ashes of each onslaught to engage in novel forms of civil resistance. After nearly 130 years of political Zionism, it is hard now to think of Palestinians without thinking of resistance. It is difficult to think of the conflict in the Holy Land without an option, or rather an opinion on the form and nature of this resistance. Because of the media conditioning in Western societies, many automatically think of armed violent resistance whenever the word resistance is mentioned. There has been no shortage of discussion of the conflict history of the political level and violence that accompany the struggle, the accusations and the counter-accusations, and so on. Many books are written in their West supporting the Zion version of history. Fewer report the Palestinian version of the same events. Occasionally, new historians challenge mythologies, sometimes decades after key events. We have seen this with the Israeli new historian Avi Shalom, Ilan Papi, Tom Segev, Shum Flapan, and Hillel Cohen, who destructed the myths around the mass exodus of native Palestinians before, during, and after the founding of Israel. Western books portraying a positive image of Palestinian history have been appreciated, but lack the full understanding that a local Palestinian author has. Critiques of a few Western historical perspectives, including John Galtung's Nonviolence in Israel-Palestine, which does a fair job showing some aspects of the period of 1987 to 1989, but suffers from ignoring the political forces at work and not analyzing the reasons behind the events he describes. The period of the 1987 Intifada is included in Peter Ackerman and Jack Duvall's A Force More Powerful, A Century of Nonviolent Resistance, and its accompanying TV program, but again in an essentially descriptive way. Another example is Mary Elizabeth King, A Quiet Revolution, The First Palestinian Intifada and Nonviolent Resistance, and is based on interviews with individuals who identify themselves as leaders of the Palestinian popular struggle. The book emphasizes the period of Palestinian resistance to Zionist colonization after 1987 and sets out an excellent framework for discussion. However, it was not well received in the Journal of Palestinian Studies. She, or King, overstates her cause by allowing her methodology and convictions to color a complex reality. Steered by her convictions and her sources inside the East Jerusalem bubble, King attempts ex post facto to force a popular uprising characterized by a powerful blend of civil disobedience and stone throwing into the ideological straitjacket of nonviolence. It doesn't fit. This is a lamentable drawback to a book that otherwise is highly readable and admirably rich in detail. And this is, I'm sorry, this is written by the Journal of Palestinian Studies, Palestine Studies. That was a quote of their critique. Madison goes on to say, I think this is exaggerated. The work of King is very good compared to treatments like those found in Herbert Adam and Kogila Moodley. More distorted accounts are found in Zionist-centric logic, which assumes that actions by Palestinians, armed or unarmed, are not resistance but are illegal, and that Israel reacts in order to defend its legitimate goals, albeit with its army sometimes not fully prepared and even overreacting. Yet other Western historians go in the opposite direction and romanticize and oversimplify the Palestinian struggle in history. These books further suffer from the flaw that the authors do not read Arabic and these cannot refer to the original data or a subject that is a struggle of an indigenous Arabic-speaking people. While having differing takes on history, most books document actions by governments and powerful leaders in conflicts. Fewer consider peace based on justice, human rights, and international law, or tell the stories or ordinary people living, adapting, and struggling in extraordinary circumstances. We find little acknowledgement of the rich history and phenomenal achievements of popular resistance in Palestine. Some books written by Westerners unfamiliar with the local language and dependent on published sources or interviews with elite Palestinians have failed to do justice to the subject. In addition to the wealth of academic literature, there is a torrent of negative and rather depressing news coming out of Palestine. Murders, economic deprivation, tortures, walls, imprisonment, home demolitions, land confiscation, corruption, denial of basic rights, lack of freedom of movement, and denial of the right of return, etc. It is hard to mobilize people who are bombarded with these issues. In this book, we document and analyze the struggle by ordinary people, Palestinians, forced to live in unusual times since the inception of the political ideology called Zionism. Such a story changes the tone of the conversation. Stories of successes and positive achievements provide incentives for further activism. We Palestinians have no shortage of inspirational unsung heroes. A respected Palestinian stated about just one period in our history, states, "Nonviolent resistance demands strong leaders. In the first days of the occupation in 1967, the Palestinian nonviolence movement had a surplus. A dynamic voluntary work movement sprang up under the guidance of democratically elected municipal councils. This movement created jobs, built schools, established youth clubs, and created public libraries." Mohammed Amar Hamadeh, Alam Palestine, from the 1st to the 15th century Hera, from the 17th to 20th century AD, lists hundreds of inspirational Palestinian leaders, authors, intellectuals, and many others. But it is hard for people to read what essentially amounts to a Palestinian who's who. In this book, we summarize and analyze the rich history of popular resistance in Palestine. The book is essentially about the power of individuals working together to transform themselves and their societies while living in exceptionally and extremely difficult circumstances. Bear with me for 1 second. I have a drink here. Now, just to give you a little insight into Madsen, not only is he living in Palestine, but he's also, he's a professor now at the at a university there, and he has been a strong advocate for Palestinian rights in this country. And I met him a number of years ago and invited him and a few other people, Palestinians and people who are and journalists. And they, I sponsored a panel discussion at the local library here in our area, and we had an excellent turnout actually for it, and I filmed it for television. And but I was amazed at the response. And I was amazed at the resentment it was called the Views from the West Bank, and Gail Townsend, who was a friend of mine, who was also Palestinian, she was on the panel and helped me organize this, and her friend Justine McCabe, who was the international on the International Council for the Green Party, and they came out with a pro-Palestinian paper, if you will, and their statements were pro-Palestinian at the time. This was back in, I believe, 2006, or 2006, and or 7, and Madsen, who was living here in Connecticut at that time, and was involved with the Palestinian Congress, and he was going talking and doing public speaking, but I was amazed at the outrage that we received by some people that we would even be promoting. In fact, our local bullshit paper wouldn't even put us in their schedule calendar, in their free calendar schedule, and we had applied 3 different times. We brought it down there 3 separate times, you know, to have it put in that paper and announced. I announced it on my radio show. I was doing a popular FM radio show at the time, and up until February of this year, when the station was leased out to NPR, believe it or not. But but I found that we had enough listeners, a good listening base, and we got a good crowd of people to come to listen. And we were Madsen was extremely patient, and as was Gail and Justine, extremely patient with their question, with some belligerent questions, and but he had a very, very good PowerPoint as well. And a slideshow that pointed out a number of issues regarding the Palestinian occupation and what that was. But, and of course, Madsen being a scholar and also a geneticist, and he was working he was a professor at Yale, but who was later thrown out, dismissed by Yale for his pro-Palestinian articles and books and activities, and later dismissed by them. He was after a number of years. So he's got tremendous credentials. I thought a PhD, of course, and but he is a man of a principle, you know, and. So I want to honor him somewhat by doing this, by reading excerpts from his book, and I hope that you pick it up. Again, the name of the book is called Popular Resistance in Palestine, and it really gives you a very, very personal, yet a very clear picture, all right, of what the resistance is in Palestine and what the Palestinian issue is. In a very, very clear way. And let me move on. Violence and nonviolence. The 20th century is perhaps the bloodiest in human history, but was also a century replete with examples of popular resistance that shaped the future without resorting to violence. Yet school history books in most countries seem to give no more than cursory attention to nonviolence. Few are written about common people's struggles, and any such books are not used by school texts as school texts. Violence seems ubiquitous. Laws and institutions in most countries focus on dealing with state-monopolized violence. Even some of our vocabulary evolves from wars and conflicts. Many common English expressions have military origins, including the whole nine yards, clean bill of health, rummage sale and show your true colors. Thus, to appreciate popular resistance, we need to know something about the culture of violence in our societies. Violence consists of actions intended to harm others on the assumption that this will help achieve a concrete result or goal. However, perceptions of what constitutes violence are highly varied. Many individuals, when confronted with examples of behaviors that hurt others, will not associate them with violent behavior. In societies that condone capital punishment, some individuals would not describe the act of executing a condemned person as an act of violence. Even when a society chooses to use extreme force against an opponent, its history, texts do not describe the society as engaging in violence, let alone terrorism. The dropping of atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which killed hundreds of thousands of civilians, is justified as a necessary option to bring World War II to an end. There are two schools of thought. One proposes that violence is encoded in our genetic makeup. The other, that it is a learned behavior, and so can be unlearned. As an evolutionary biologist and geneticist, and having examined the issue in some detail, I would contend that the answer lies somewhere between the two, that our evolutionary history gave us a blueprint for violence, altruism, and collaboration, while giving us the intellectual ability to educate for or against violence in meaningful ways. Popular resistance is far more coherent philosophically than violent resistance. Societal violence has traditionally been legitimized and legalized, while violence by non-state actors has been denounced and made illegal, giving the state a monopoly on its use. Abelard explains how strong states like the U.S. and Israel have engaged in acts of war without calling it war in the name of law enforcement. Those who engage in violent action legitimize what they would, according to what they consider as good means to a legitimate end. The cause of opponents is not considered legitimate, and their use of violence is not justified. No party aims to establish a nonviolent society, and those who justify the use of violence, those who justify the use of violence base their argument on the justice of the ends. The ends justify the means. And of course, man, I'll tell you, I mean, the United States, if there ever was, or Israel for that matter, if there ever was a justification of violence, jeez, I mean, we're living it. Whether one accepts the violent means criteria or not, it is a useful means to help achieve the ends sought. That is where the discussion mostly focuses, the issue of utility, and thus opens up violent logic to self-contradictions. Rulers and occupiers maintain a power structure to dictate their agendas. As such, resistance typically focuses on changing the power structure. Historians can only offer examples of a mix of violent and nonviolent actions to varied degrees. Some may argue that the Algerian Revolution against the French occupation resorted more to violent resistance, while the Indian Revolution against British colonial rule relied more on nonviolent resistance. It is impossible to come up with quantitative measures to say a revolution was 60% or 80% nonviolent. The closest we can come is presumably to compare the number of people killed while resisting violently and those who are killed resisting nonviolently. However, this is a subjective and highly fluid judgment. Colonizers often claim they shot protesters because soldiers or police officers' lives were at risk. We also know that in some cases, Israeli undercover agents have thrown rocks or opened fire in demonstrations to create the pretext for shooting. That's happening everywhere, not just in Israel. There are provocateurs all over the place, in every riot, even in this country. The false dichotomy, sometimes argued, is that societies can choose to use moral methods that are ineffective, such as nonviolent resistance, or amoral methods that are effective, such as violent insurrection. But this is essentially a misleading and defeatist attitude which ignores both the history and possibilities of humanity, while overlooking the reality that it is individuals, not societies, who make choices. In reflecting on apartheid South Africa, people in the West tend to forget that the African National Congress, led by Nelson Mandela, was a guerrilla movement fighting violently for liberation as well as using various forms of popular resistance. Individuals who believe in violence tend to minimize the role of people like Desmond Tutu, Mahatma Gandhi, and Martin Luther King Jr., while others tend to consider them key elements of change in society. Ironically, in both situations, some argue that liberation would not have been won without violent resistance, while others argue that it could not have been won without nonviolent resistance. This is a moot point because its foundations is a hypothetical situation that has never existed. All struggles to date have used both violent and nonviolent resistance. Can we really know exactly what the tipping point was in each situation? Can we truly say that what would have happened to the civil rights movement without the good cop of Martin Luther King Jr. and the bad cop, Malcolm X? History is usually written by the victors. Thus, the leaders of the Algerian Revolution consider that violence was the key to ending the French colonial occupation. In the transformation of the U.S. in the 1960s, historians typically emphasize popular resistance over the influence of the Black Panthers and Malcolm X, and so we find no national holidays commemorating the life and sacrifices of Malcolm X, Crazy Horse, or Geronimo. What would have happened in South Africa without Tutu's popular resistance or Mandela's more violent struggle? For that matter, can we imagine what would have happened without diversity within the oppressor's population? As President Johnson, or King, or Malcolm X, or critical in searching and securing popular rights in the U.S., do Israeli groups like the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolitions, or B'Tselem, which is make a vital difference? I think the answer given by advocates in favor of the dichotomy are not that simple. But as an individual, I can make a judgment as to what I can and should do without cursing or condemning alternative judgments. The Stanford Prison Experiment shows that humans are highly influenced by circumstances. In this experiment, students are randomly assigned to play the role of prisoner or prison guard. The experiment had to be halted, in a matter of days because nearly a third of the prison guards started exhibiting abusive behaviors, and many of the prisoners began to show signs of psychological disturbance. William J. Thompson suggests a hierarchy of violence from lower personal to higher societal, and suggests some trends. The lower in the hierarchy, or rather the physical, the more widely available is the form of violence. That is, physical violence is potentially available to almost everyone, and from numerous studies, Stanley Milgram's Obedience to Authority's work, he quotes, "We must reluctantly conclude that almost everyone is capable of physical violence under appropriate circumstances." Higher forms of violence, e.g. economic, are reserved for those with the resources to implement them. general, higher forms of violence are more likely to be successful over lower forms of violence. In general, people will use the highest form of violence available to them because it is less physically and otherwise dangerous. The powerful differentials and likelihood of success are greater, and it is more likely to be legal. This is a key point. Violence of any kind tends to elicit a violent response. That's very interesting. The more money you got, the more legal your method of violence is. You can destroy somebody economically, and they'll have plenty of suffering that way. Excuse me.
A little throaty tonight there. Violent tactics are often defended as unpleasant means to a good end. This argument is presented by both strong and weak parties. The justice of the end justifying the means is referred to as the natural law argument. Others try to justify violence in terms of the illegality of the means, irrespective of the justice of the end. In such a logic, the person committing the violence must do it under a legal guise accepted by society. A soldier participating in a defensive action, or a prison warden executing a prisoner sentenced to death. I want to stop here for just 1 second, because an interesting thing happened a number of years ago, and where I was at the time he was a friend of mine, and this guy, and he was I'm not talking about Mazzanier at all. This is another guy, and he was actually an educated man, a professor, a former professor, retired, who, in all retrospect, now seemed like a logical thinking person. Until one afternoon where he and I had an explosive argument over the Palestinian issue, where he felt strongly that government-sponsored genocide was right. I, on the other hand, was totally appalled that he could think that way. Totally, absolutely appalled. And I could never rectify that in my mind, how this man could do it. And I questioned him, and he reiterated that, yes, you know. And he had been involved I believe his source was probably, I believe now he was probably a CIA plant, and also a provocateur in this area, as well as in the other areas that he was involved in. But more so, what bothered me was to see that mindset, okay, that he could possibly be accepting genocide, and not only accepting it, but promoting it, especially in the case of the Palestinians and the Israelis. It made absolutely no sense to me whatsoever. And of course, being part Indian, I would have taken offense to that in any way. But being just a reasonably compassionate individual, that kind of logic was so alien to me. It was so barbaric to come from an educated person that But later on, several years, since then, I've seen it in so many other people and their acceptance, and I see it in our Congress. I see it in the Israelis. I see it, and it's so horrifying. It's so horrifying to me to see this happening, especially to the Palestinian people. And of course, I am pro I am nonviolent in that sense, but at the same time, if my life is threatened, if my personal life is threatened, or my family is threatened by violence, and I'm not going to kowtow. I'm going to find a baseball bat or whatever I can, or a knife or a gun or whatever, and try to defend myself. And I'm not going to get, if somebody has every intent to kill you, all right, I don't think nonviolence is going to win the day. You're going to be dead, all right? So, that's my feeling about this. And of course, it falls right in line here with this. But, again, a popular resistance is both. And I believe, firmly believe, that had it not been for the threat of Malcolm X, the threat of the Black Panthers, the threat of a violent uprising by the Black Americans during the 60s, Martin Luther King would not have been anywhere near as effective, because what happened was Kennedy and Johnson embraced Martin Luther King because they didn't want violence. They wanted, they felt they could work with them, even though the sons of bitches killed Martin Luther King in 1968, and that's verified. And that's been verified that the government actually authorized the murder of Martin Luther King Jr. And the Martin Luther King Jr. family won a wrongful death suit against the government, okay, in 1999. All right, and that's not very well known, but you can look it up, and it's true. It really did happen, and the government settled with the King family, all right? But they were found guilty of wrongful death, So Martin Luther King, Gandhi was shot. Martin Luther King was shot. All of your nonviolent, Christ was killed. All of your nonviolent revolutionaries were eventually murdered, and that's the irony of the whole thing, if you will. But anyway, let me finish this. In our case, violent resistance by Palestinians was used as a justification to brutalize the population, further uproot us, and destroy our homes and lands, both at the time of the British Mandate and after 1948. This policy took advantage of a natural reaction to colonial domination by intensifying colonial activity. Traditionally, the Zionist response to injury or attack on settlers has been to remove more Palestinians and build more settlements. Israel monopolizes the use of state power, leaving Palestinians little hope of containing the cancerous growth of colonial settlements on their land by violent methods. The exceptions are few and do not nullify that generalization. Some Palestinians state that Israel's evacuation of the Gaza Strip was due to armed resistance. This is only partly true because Israel, like any power, calculates the risks and rewards of any action. It calculated that in public relations, diplomatic and economic benefits of the withdrawing settlers and soldiers from Gaza, while maintaining the occupation of Gaza by siege, far outweighed the small disadvantage of empowering those who support violent resistance. We must all be cognizant of the usual imbalance of power between the two, and the fact that colonialization never happens peacefully. Colonizers always use violence because it is the only way to remove people from the land, while those being colonized can choose to resist by other means. The development of state power results in war and wars being waged without calling them wars, and dispensing violence with declaring war. There are arguments to be made on all sides. Did the scalping of European settlers by Native Americans terrorize them into leaving the land? Or did it inflame passions and enforce stereotypes of savagery, which resulted in accelerated colonialization? Psychological studies done on suicide bombers show the perpetrators are driven not by nationalistic ideologies, but largely by desire for revenge. After their homes have been demolished, their relatives injured, land or mobbed, or jobs confiscated. Ideologies such as imperialism, Zionism, or Nazism, held by those in power of positions of power, obviously provided a far greater incentive to resort to violence. We do recognize that nonviolence is a possibility, and it does happen that people who engage in violence later decide to abandon it. This is true both for violence that is considered legitimate in international law, resistance to colonialism and occupation, and violence considered illegitimate, occupation, ethnic cleansing, etc. Armed resistance by the occupied must be carried out in clandestine occupations under constant threat of infiltration and liquidation by the colonializers. Thus, such resistance requires strong leaders and executive power and limited circles of consultation. Leadership cannot reasonably be assigned by popular vote and democratic structures and guerrilla institutions because of safety issues, and security issues. The skill of managing such operations are very different from those required to manage governmental institutions by democratic means. Leadership of popular resistance can evolve organically in different directions. It can be elected democratically, and its leaders generally cannot resist effectively without the widest consultation possible of those involved. And this also discourages the cult of leadership. The biologically limited lifespan of a leader is insignificant compared to the more meaningful lifespan of the people and its struggle. Resistance by violent means has far more constraints and is more likely to fail than popular resistance because it requires much more logistical support, arms, etc., secrecy, killing of armed combatants, difficulty in establishing geographic areas for armed control, and much, much more. This is particularly true when armed resistance has to contend with leaders from among its own people who are collaborating with the occupiers, which is the case of Fatah, and so on. Another point to consider is that when resistance fails, nonviolent forms leave far less devastation, social, economic lives lost, etc., than armed resistance. That is not to say that this form of resistance is safe. On the contrary, popular resistance can in many situations be more dangerous than armed resistance. After all, we have only our bodies and willingness to suffer. In fact, in many ways, it is reliant on willingness to suffer by the people. All leaders of popular resistance, when articulating thoughts on this, explained how willful subjugation to suffering can itself be an empowering event and also confuses and confounds the opponents. Bishop Munib Yunan explains the concept of willingness to suffer for the cause of resistance. The Church needs a theology of martyria. It is martyrdom. It is a concept misunderstood, misused, and even missed from the vocabulary of many Christians. What does it mean to be a martyr? In a simple sense, it means no more than to be a witness. That is how it is translated from Greek. It means a life of witnessing in word and also in deed. And the third component is suffering. Materia is expressed when one's faith makes one vulnerable to the suffering in the world. It means exposing yourself, risking one's life for the other. On terminology, people who participate in revolutions against oppression are always diverse. Some support armed resistance, some support popular resistance, some support both. There is no clear division between the three groups due to extensive overlap and subdivisions. Among those who support armed resistance, there are always arguments about what kind of violence is justified in defense of a just cause. Among those who support nonviolent resistance, there are arguments about what defines it. Popular resistance can be active or passive. In the active form, there are also questions about the popular forms that do not cross the line into violent resistance. In damaging infrastructure Is damaging infrastructure used for oppression violent? I would say so. Mahatma Gandhi used the Urdu word satyagraha because he had a problem of vocabulary similar to that faced by Khalid Kistani. Nonviolence in Arabic is not the best translation of Gandhi's Ashima in Urdu. To avoid this negative hint, he agreed on civilian resistance or civilian struggle. But I advocate civilian jihad to give it a Muslim coloring. Other writers are now using this term, and the Sudanese leader and former Prime Minister al-Sadiq al-Mahdi adopted it for his concept of nonviolence. The term was inspired by a hadith that the Prophet pronounced wherever he came back from battle. Or whenever he came back from battle. We returned from the minor jihad to the major jihad, meaning from military action to civilian work. And the abused and unmisunderstood term jihad does not mean holy war, but the exertion of effort. Mukawama Shabia, the term commonly used in Palestine, is roughly translated as popular resistance. The word Shabia has its roots in Shab, or people, and is understood by many Palestinians to refer to the kind of resistance practiced by large numbers of the population, as opposed to more narrow armed resistance. On the other hand, we do have in common use Thara, Shabia, or People's Revolution. When I asked 20 Palestinians on the street of Bethlehem what they understood the difference was between Thara Shabia and Mukawama Shabia, 14 suggested that violence is more characteristic of the former than the latter. In English, it is more accurate to use nonviolent resistance to differentiate it from violent resistance. But the term translated literally into Arabic would be a very poor and rather negative description of the complex and empowering acts of popular resistance practiced in Palestine that cannot count as armed resistance. But because of the limitations of the language, we shall use the term popular resistance in this book. Popular resistance is as old as humanity, but key people are frequently cited as inspirational in their shedding of violence and embarking on the path of popular resistance. Mahatma Gandhi, also known as the honorific title Mahatma, meaning great soul, successfully developed and used many strategies of nonviolent resistance. He developed the concept of satyagraha, a word that is derived from the Sanskrit word satya, which means truth, and graha, meaning steadfastness, and samud in Arabic. This concept involves far more than persistence in telling the truth, and is considered an active form of willingness to sacrifice oneself in order to achieve justice. Samud also conjures up many images that reflect steadfastness, persistence, and success in the face of difficult obstacles. It is not mere passive patience in the face of adversity, but rather an active form of popular resistance. Gandhi's other concept, Ashimsa, is also hard to translate. It is wrong to translate it to nonviolence in the negative. In Sanskrit, the concept includes a mix of love, honesty, non-aggression, and peace. Non-aggression and peace. Gandhi recognized that there are no enemies, but only those we should challenge because of their actions that harm the people. Change for the self-proclaimed enemy is the ultimate triumph of humanity and truth. The change of the self-proclaimed enemy is the ultimate triumph of humanity and truth. I think that's kind of an interesting concept. Very interesting. Chapter 2 is entitled What We Want: Plurality, Justice, and Human Rights. He has another quote by Martin Luther King. I believe that wounded justice, lying prostrate on the blood-flowing streets of our nations, can be lifted from the dust of shame to reign supreme among the children of men. I have the audacity to believe that peoples everywhere can have three meals a day for their bodies, education and culture for their minds, and dignity, equality, and freedom for their spirits. Now, what's wrong with that dream? And why is it being deprived? Why are the Israelis depriving it to the Palestinians? Why is that? What right do they have to do that? What right does anybody have to deprive people of that right? The right to education. The right to three meals a day. Or even one meal a day, for crying out loud. And the dignity, equality, and freedom of their spirits. I mean, that's only right. That's only right. Why does the United States and Israel and so many other nations, European nations, practice this colonization, practice this occupation, practice this violence against other people, when all they want is some freedom? And the right to live. Basic human right. The evolution of the methods and strategies of resistance in Palestine have been no different than other struggles by people facing a colonial settler population. There are many comparative studies of the struggles of the people of Palestine, Native Americans, South Africans, and under apartheid, Algerians under French rule, and Vietnamese and others. While each historical situation is unique, we can point to similarities pertinent to our discussion of resistance. First and foremost, when history is written objectively about all these struggles, there is never any question of the right of the people being colonized to defend themselves and mount a vigorous resistance to those opposing them. Internationally recognized leaders of popular resistance have expressed opinions on Palestine. Martin Luther King Jr. stated in a letter about the tripartite French, Britain, and Israel attack on Egypt, I have been keeping up with the situation in Egypt, and as you know, this is one of those most important issues in the world today. It will determine whether we live in peace or whether we will die in war. Naturally, my sympathies are with Egypt rather than with the Western colonial and imperial powers. 1 year later, he was killed. Support of oppressed people in his country could not have separated from support of oppressed people in other places. While some tried to convince him not to push for an end to the war in Vietnam,
He explicitly rejected those calls. This is the nature of activist work and the existence, or the essence of thinking as a human being, not in terms of narrow national, religious, and other contexts. It is thus not surprising that Mahatma Gandhi had a strong opinion on Palestine. I'm going to continue with this for the archives here. I just want to mention his quote of Mahatma Gandhi. My sympathies are with the Jews. I have known them intimately in South Africa. Some of them became lifelong companions. Through these friends, I came to learn much of their age-long persecution. They have been the untouchables of Christianity. The parallel between their treatment by Christians and the treatment of untouchables by Hindus is very close. Religious sanction has been invoked in most cases for the justification of the inhuman treatment meted out to them. Apart from the friendships, therefore, there is the more common universal reason for my sympathy for the Jews. But my sympathy does not blind me to the requirements of justice. The cry for the national home for the Jews does not make much appeal to me. The sanction for it is sought in the Bible, and the tenacity with which the Jews have hankered after return to Palestine. Why should they not, like other people on earth, make that country their home, where they are born and where they earn their livelihood? Palestine belongs to the Arabs in the same sense that England belongs to the English or French, or France to the French. It is wrong and inhuman to impose the Jews on the Arabs. What is going on in Palestine today cannot be justified by any moral code of conduct. The mandates have no sanctions but that of the last war. Surely it would be a crime against humanity to reduce the proud Arabs to that Palestine can be restored to the Jews, partly or wholly as their national home. The nobler course would be to insist on a just treatment of the Jews wherever they are born and bred. The Jews born in France are French, in precisely the same sense the Christians born in France are French. If the Jews have no home but Palestine, will they relish the idea of being forced to leave their other part of the world in which they are settled? Or do they want a double home where they can remain at will? This cry for a national home affords a comfortable justification for the German expulsion of the Jews. And now, a word for the Jews in Palestine. I have no doubt that they are going about it in the wrong way. The Palestine of the biblical conception is not a geographical tract. It is in their hearts. But if they must look to Palestine or geography as their national home, it is wrong to enter it under the shadow of the British gun. A religious act cannot be performed with the aid of the bayonet or the bomb, and they can settle in Palestine only by the goodwill of the Arabs. They should seek to convert the Arab heart. And that's what he said in 1938. So Gandhi was against this as well. Gandhi was against the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Martin Luther King was against the occupation, Israeli occupation of Palestine. I am against it. The rest of the entire world is against it. All right? So why is the United States Congress, and I say Congress because I don't believe that any conscious American has any sympathy for Israel in this regard, not in the occupation and the boycotting and the bombing and the destruction of Palestine or of Lebanon or of any of the surrounding areas. Israel has no right to be there. you want to go against the words of Martin Luther King, Mahatma Gandhi, all right, then so be it. Anyway, I'm going to leave it at that. There's much more, and Mazen wrote a brilliant book. I highly, highly recommend that you get it. It's well researched, well, a good bibliography. It's just tremendous. So, again, I ask you to pick up this book called The Popular Resistance in Palestine, A Hope for a History of Hope and Empowerment. And just to write a quick thing on this, I just want to mention Mazen's a little bit of a bio on him. He's a professor of Bethlehem and Brisbane universities, and works with a number of civil society organizations. He has published over 1,000 articles in newspapers, journals, books, and internet outlets. And his previous book includes Sharing the Land of Canaan, that was published by Pluto in 2004, and Mammals of the Holy Land in 1996. And this is his third book. And it's a great book. Just a great book. Mazen Qumsiyeh, Qumsiyeh. Highly recommend you get it. And I hope that sheds some light on the Palestinian issue. If not, well, then, you know, you're probably blinded by your bigotry, but that's okay. No, it's not okay. Not according to the great men who also opposed the occupation of Israel, or Israeli occupation of Palestine. So, I'll leave it at that, and I wish you the best. Please join us tomorrow night when we discuss the Mayan calendar and the current events, the polar shift, and the earthquakes, and everything that's predicted. Also, the coming of Ellen and the comet, and the Hopi prophecies. So please join us tomorrow night right here at 8 o'clock. And I wish you all the best. Let's see here if I can find my ending music somewhere. Okay. So have a good evening, folks. And don't forget the book, Popular Resistance in Palestine. Check it out on Amazon.com.